the other. The rise of government and commerce and the plummeting of homicide that propelled the civilizing process had been underway for several centuries without anyone much caring about the barbarity of punishments, the power of kings, or the violent suppression of heresy. Indeed, as states became more powerful, they also got crueler. The use of torture to extract confessions, rather than to punish, for example, was reintroduced in the Middle Ages when many states revived Roman law. Something else must have accelerated humanitarian sentiments in the 17th and 18th centuries. An alternative explanation is that people become more compassionate as their own lives improve. Paine speculates that when people grow richer so that they are better fed, healthier, and more comfortable, they come to value their own lives and the lives of others more highly. The hypothesis that life used to be cheap but has become dearer loosely fits within the broad sweep of history. Over the millennia, the world has moved away from barbaric practices like human sacrifice and sadistic executions, and over the millennia, people have been living longer and in greater comfort. Countries that were at the leading edge of the abolition of cruelty, such as 17th century England and Holland, were also among the more affluent countries of their time. And today, it is in the poorer corners of the world that we continue to find backwaters with slavery, superstitious killing, and other barbaric customs. But the life was cheap hypothesis also has some problems. Many of the more affluent states of their day, such as the Roman Empire, were hotbeds of sadism. And today, harsh punishments like amputations and stonings may be found among the wealthy oil-exporting nations of the Middle East. A bigger problem is that the timing is off. Affluence began its liftoff only with the advent of the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century. Before 1800, the mathematics of Malthus prevailed. Any advance in producing food only bred more mouths to feed, leaving the population as poor as before. This was true not only in England, but all over the world. Between 1200 and 1800, measures of economic well-being such as income, calories per capita, protein per capita, and number of surviving children per woman showed no upward trend in any European country. Indeed, they were barely above the levels of hunter-gatherer societies. Only when the Industrial Revolution introduced more efficient manufacturing techniques and built an infrastructure of canals and railroads did European economies start to shoot upward and the populace become more affluent. Yet the humanitarian changes we are trying to explain began in the 17th century and were concentrated in the 18th. Even if we could show that affluence correlated with humanitarian sensibilities, it would be hard to pinpoint the reasons. Money does not just fill the belly and put a roof over one's head. It also buys better governments, higher rates of literacy, greater mobility, and other goods. Also, it's not completely obvious that poverty and misery should lead people to enjoy torturing others. One could just as easily make the opposite prediction. If you have first-hand experience of pain and deprivation, you should be unwilling to inflict them on others. Whereas if you have lived a cushy life, the suffering of others is less real to you. I will return to the life was cheap hypothesis in the final chapter, but for now we must seek other candidates for an exogenous change that made people more compassionate. One technology that did show a precocious increase in productivity before the Industrial Revolution was book production. Before Gutenberg's invention of the printing press in 1452, every copy of a book had to be written out by hand. Not only was the process time-consuming, it took 37 person days to produce the equivalent of a 250-page book, but it was inefficient in materials and energy. Handwriting is harder to read than type is, and so handwritten books had to be larger, using up more paper and making the book more expensive to bind, store, and ship. In the two centuries after Gutenberg, publishing became a high-tech venture, and productivity in printing and papermaking grew more than 20-fold, faster than the growth rate of the entire British economy during the Industrial Revolution. The newly efficient publishing technology set off an explosion in book publication. The number of books published per year rose significantly in the 17th century and shot up toward the end of the 18th. The books, moreover, were not just playthings for aristocrats and intellectuals. As the literary scholar Suzanne Keene notes, by the late 18th century, circulating libraries had become widespread in London and provincial towns, and most of what they offered for rent was novels. With more numerous and cheaper books available, people had a greater incentive to read. It's not easy to estimate the level of literacy in periods before the advent of universal schooling and standardized testing, but historians have used clever proxy measures, such as the proportion of people who could sign their marriage registers or court declarations. Clark suggests that during the 17th century in England, rates of literacy doubled, and that by the end of the century, a majority of Englishmen had learned to read and write. Literacy was increasing in other parts of Western Europe at the same time. By the late 18th century, a majority of French citizens had become literate, and though estimates of literacy don't appear for other countries until later, they suggest that by the early 19th century, a majority of men were literate in Denmark, Finland, Germany, Iceland, Scotland, Sweden, and Switzerland as well. Not only were more people reading, but they were reading in different ways, a development the historian Rolf Engelsing has called the reading revolution. People began to read secular rather than just religious material, to read to themselves instead of in groups, and to read a wide range of topical media, such as pamphlets and periodicals, rather than rereading a few canonical texts like almanacs, devotional works, and the Bible. As the historian Robert Darnton put it, the late 18th century does seem to represent a turning point, a time when more reading matter became available to a wider public, when one can see the emergence of a mass readership that would grow to giant proportions in the 19th century with the development of machine-made paper, steam-powered presses, linotype, and nearly universal literacy. And, of course, people in the 17th and 18th centuries had more to read about. The scientific revolution had revealed that everyday experience is a narrow slice of a vast continuum of scales from the microscopic to the astronomical, and that our own abode is a rock orbiting a star rather than the center of creation. The European exploration of the Americas, Oceania, and Africa, and the discovery of sea routes to India and Asia had opened up new worlds and revealed the existence of exotic peoples with ways of life very different from the reader's own. The growth of writing and literacy strikes me as the best candidate for an exogenous change that helped set off the humanitarian revolution. The pokey little world of village and clan, accessible through the five senses and informed by a single content provider, the church, gave way to a phantasmagoria of people, places, cultures, and ideas. And for several reasons, the expansion of people's minds could have added a dose of humanitarianism to their emotions and their beliefs. The rise of empathy and the regard for human life. The human capacity for compassion is not a reflex that is triggered automatically by the presence of another living thing. As we shall see in Chapter 9, though people in all cultures can react sympathetically to kin, friends, and babies, they tend to hold back when it comes to larger circles of neighbors, strangers, foreigners, and other sentient beings. In his book, The Expanding Circle, the philosopher Peter Singer has argued that, over the course of history, people have enlarged the range of beings whose interests they value as they value their own. An interesting question is what inflated the empathy circle, and a good candidate is the expansion of literacy. Reading is a technology for perspective taking. When someone else's thoughts are in your head, you are observing the world from that person's vantage point. Not only are you taking in sights and sounds that you could not experience firsthand, but you have stepped inside that person's mind and are temporarily sharing his or her attitudes and reactions. As we shall see, empathy, in the sense of adopting someone's viewpoint, is not the same as empathy, in the sense of feeling compassion toward the person, but the first can lead to the second by a natural route. Stepping into someone else's vantage point reminds you that the other fellow has a first-person, present-tense, ongoing stream of consciousness that is very much like your own, but not the same as your own. It's not a big leap to suppose that the habit of reading other people's words could put one in the habit of entering other people's minds, including their pleasures and pains. Slipping even for a moment into the perspective of someone who is turning black in a pillory, or desperately pushing burning faggots away from her body, or convulsing under the 200th stroke of the lash, may give a person second thoughts as to whether these cruelties should ever be visited upon anyone. Adopting other people's vantage points can alter one's convictions in other ways. Exposure to worlds that can be seen only through the eyes of a foreigner, an explorer, or a historian can turn an unquestioned norm, "That's the way it's done," into an explicit observation. That's what our tribe happens to do now. This self-consciousness is the first step toward asking whether the practice could be done in some other way. Also, learning that over the course of history, the first can become the last, and the last can become first, may instill the habit of mind that reminds us, "There but for fortune go I." The power of literacy to lift readers out of their parochial stations is not confined to factual writing. We have already seen how satirical fiction, which transports readers into a hypothetical world from which they can observe the follies of their own, may be an effective way to change people's sensibilities without haranguing or sermonizing. Realistic fiction, for its part, may expand readers' circle of empathy by seducing them into thinking and feeling like people very different from themselves. Literature students are taught that the 18th century was a turning point in the history of the novel. It became a form of mass entertainment, and by the end of the century, almost 100 new novels were published in England and France every year. And unlike earlier epics which recounted the exploits of heroes, aristocrats, or saints, the novels brought to life the aspirations and losses of ordinary people. Lynn Hunt points out that the heyday of the humanitarian revolution, the late 18th century, was also the heyday of the epistolary novel. In this genre, the story unfolds in a character's own words, exposing the character's thoughts and feelings in real time, rather than describing them from the distancing perspective of a disembodied narrator. In the middle of the century, three melodramatic novels named after female protagonists became unlikely bestsellers: Samuel Richardson's Pamela, 1740, and Clarissa, 1748, and Rousseau's Julie, or The New Eloise, 1761. Grown men burst into tears while experiencing the forbidden loves, intolerable arranged marriages, and cruel twists of fate in the lives of undistinguished women, including servants, with whom they had nothing in common. A retired military officer, writing to Rousseau, gushed, "You have driven me crazy about her. Imagine, then, the tears that her death must have wrung from me. Never have I wept such delicious tears." That reading created such a powerful effect on me that I believe I would have gladly died during that supreme moment. The philosophes of the Enlightenment extolled the way novels engaged a reader's identification with and sympathetic concern for others. In his eulogy for Richardson, Diderot wrote, "One takes, despite all precautions, a role in his works. You are thrown into conversation. You approve, you blame, you admire. You become irritated, you feel indignant." How many times did I not surprise myself, as it happens to children who have been taken to the theater for the first time, crying, "Don't believe it! He is deceiving you!" His characters are taken from ordinary society. The passions he depicts are those I feel in myself. The clergy, of course, denounced these novels and placed several on the index of forbidden books. One Catholic cleric wrote, "Open these works, and you will see in almost all of them the rights of divine and human justice violated, parents' authority over their children scorned, the sacred bonds of marriage and friendship broken. Hunt suggests a causal chain. Reading epistolary novels about characters unlike oneself exercises the ability to put oneself in other people's shoes, which turns one against cruel punishments and other abuses of human rights. As usual, it is hard to rule out alternative explanations for the correlation. Perhaps people became more empathic for other reasons, which simultaneously made them receptive to epistolary novels and concerned with others' mistreatment. But the full-strength causal hypothesis may be more than a fantasy of English teachers. The ordering of events is in the right direction. Technological advances in publishing, the mass production of books, the expansion of literacy, and the popularity of the novel all preceded the major humanitarian reforms of the 18th century. And in some cases, a best-selling novel or memoir demonstrably exposed a wide range of readers to the suffering of a forgotten class of victims and led to a change in policy. Around the same time that Uncle Tom's Cabin mobilized abolitionist sentiment in the United States, Charles Dickens's Oliver Twist, 1838, and Nicholas Nickleby, 1839, opened people's eyes to the mistreatment of children in British workhouses and orphanages, and Richard Henry Dana's 2 Years Before the Mast, A Personal Narrative of Life at Sea, 1840, and Herman Melville's White Jacket, helped end the flogging of sailors. In the past century, Eric Maria Remarque's All Quiet on the Western Front, George Orwell's 1984, Arthur Koestler's Darkness at Noon, Alexander Solzhenitsyn's One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, Elie Wiesel's Night, Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, Alex Haley's Roots, Anchi Min's Red Azalea, Azar Nafisi's Reading Lolita in Tehran, and Alice Walker's Possessing the Secret of Joy, a novel that features female genital mutilation, all raised public awareness of the suffering of people who might otherwise have been ignored. Cinema and television reached even larger audiences and offered experiences that were even more immediate. In Chapter 9, we will learn of experiments that confirm that fictional narratives can evoke people's empathy and prick them to action. Whether or not novels in general, or epistolary novels in particular, were the critical genre in expanding empathy, the explosion of reading may have contributed to the humanitarian revolution by getting people into the habit of straying from their parochial vantage points, and it may have contributed in a second way, by creating a hothouse for new ideas about moral values and the social order. The Republic of Letters and Enlightenment Humanism. In David Lodge's 1988 novel, Small World, a professor explains why he believes that the elite university has become obsolete. Information is much more portable in the modern world than it used to be. So are people. There are three things which have revolutionized academic life in the last 20 years: jet travel, direct dialing telephones, and the Xerox machine. As long as you have access to a telephone, a Xerox machine, and a conference grant fund, you're okay. You're plugged into the only university that really matters, the global campus. Morris Zapp had a point, but he overemphasized the technologies of the 1980s. 2 decades after his words were written, they have been superseded by email, digital documents, websites, blogs, teleconferencing, Skype, and smartphones. And 2 centuries before they were written, the technologies of the day, the sailing ship, the printed book, and the postal service, had already made information and people portable. The result was the same: a global campus, a public sphere, or as it was called in the 17th and 18th centuries, the Republic of Letters. Any 21st century reader who dips into intellectual history can't help but be impressed by the blogosphere of the 18th. No sooner did a book appear than it would sell out, get reprinted, get translated into 6 languages, and spawn a flurry of commentary in pamphlets, correspondence, and additional books. Thinkers like Locke and Newton exchanged tens of thousands of letters. Voltaire alone wrote more than 18,000, which now fill 15 volumes. Of course, this colloquy unfolded on a scale that by today's standards was glacial. Weeks, sometimes even months. But it was rapid enough that ideas could be broached, criticized, amalgamated, refined, and brought to the attention of people in power. A signature example is Beccaria's On Crimes and Punishments, which became an instant sensation and the impetus for the abolition of cruel punishments throughout Europe. Given enough time and purveyors, a marketplace of ideas can not only disseminate ideas, but change their composition. No one is smart enough to figure out anything worthwhile from scratch. As Newton, hardly a humble man, conceded in a 1675 letter to fellow scientist Robert Hooke, "If I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants." The human mind is adept at packaging a complicated idea into a chunk, combining it with other ideas into a more complex assembly, packaging that assembly into a still bigger contrivance, combining it with still other ideas, and so on. But to do so, it needs a steady supply of plug-ins and sub-assemblies, which can come only from a network of other minds. A global campus increases not only the complexity of ideas, but their quality. In hermetic isolation, all kinds of bizarre and toxic ideas can fester. Sunlight is the best disinfectant, and exposing a bad idea to the critical glare of other minds provides at least a chance that it will wither and die. Superstitions, dogmas, and legends ought to have a shorter half-life in a republic of letters, together with bad ideas about how to control crime or run a country. Setting fire to a person and seeing whether he burns is a dumb way to determine his guilt. Executing a woman for copulating with devils and turning them into cats is equally inane. And unless you are a hereditary absolutist monarch, you are unlikely to be persuaded that hereditary absolutist monarchy is the optimal form of government. The jet airplane is the only technology of Lodge's Small World of 1988 that has not been made obsolete by the Internet. And that reminds us that sometimes there is no substitute for face-to-face communication. Airplanes can bring people together, but people who live in a city are already together, so cities have long been crucibles of ideas. Cosmopolitan cities can bring together a critical mass of diverse minds, and their nooks and crannies can offer places for mavericks to seek refuge. The Age of Reason and the Enlightenment were also an age of urbanization. London, Paris, and Amsterdam became intellectual bazaars, and thinkers congregated in their salons, coffee houses, and bookstores to hash out the ideas of the day. Amsterdam played a special role as an arena of ideas. During the Dutch Golden Age in the 17th century, it became a bustling port, open to the flow of goods, ideas, money, and people. It accommodated Catholics, Anabaptists, Protestants of various denominations, and Jews whose ancestors had been expelled from Portugal. It housed many book publishers who did a brisk business printing controversial books and exporting them to the countries in which they had been banned. One Amsterdamer, Spinoza, subjected the Bible to literary analysis and developed a theory of everything that left no room for an animate God. In 1656, he was excommunicated by his Jewish community, who, with memories of the Inquisition still fresh, were nervous about making waves among the surrounding Christians. It was no tragedy for Spinoza, as it might have been if he had lived in an isolated village, because he just picked up and moved to a new neighborhood, and from there to another tolerant Dutch city, Leiden. In both places, he was welcomed into the community of writers, thinkers, and artists. John Locke used Amsterdam as a safe haven in 1683, after he had been suspected of taking part in a plot against King Charles II in England. René Descartes also changed addresses frequently, bouncing around Holland and Sweden whenever things got too hot. The economist Edward Glaser has credited the rise of cities with the emergence of liberal democracy. Oppressive autocrats can remain in power even when their citizens despise them, because of a conundrum that economists call the social dilemma, or free rider problem. In a dictatorship, the autocrat and his henchmen have a strong incentive to stay in power, but no individual citizen has an incentive to depose him, because the rebel would assume all the risks of the dictator's reprisals, while the benefits of democracy would flow diffusely to everyone in the country. The crucible of a city, however, can bring together financiers, lawyers, writers, publishers, and well-connected merchants who can collude in pubs and guild halls to challenge the current leadership, dividing the labor and diffusing the risk. Classical Athens, Renaissance Venice, revolutionary Boston and Philadelphia, and the cities of the Low Countries are examples of cities where new democracies were gestated. And today, urbanization and democracy tend to go together. The subversive power of the flow of information and people has never been lost on political and religious tyrants. That is why they suppress speech, writing, and association, and why democracies protect these channels in their bills of rights. Before the rise of cities and literacy, liberating ideas had a harder time being conceived and amalgamated, and so the rise of cosmopolitanism in the 17th and 18th centuries deserves part of the credit for the humanitarian revolution. Bringing people and ideas together, of course, does not determine how those ideas will evolve. The rise of the Republic of Letters and the cosmopolitan city cannot, by themselves, explain why a humanitarian ethics arose in the 18th century, rather than ever more ingenious rationales for torture, slavery, despotism, and war. My own view is that the two developments really are linked. When a large enough community of free, rational agents confers on how a society should run its affairs, steered by logical consistency and feedback from the world, their consensus will veer in certain directions. Just as we don't have to explain why molecular biologists discovered that DNA has four bases, given that they were doing their biology properly, and given that DNA really does have four bases, in the long run, they could hardly have discovered anything else. We may not have to explain why enlightened thinkers would eventually argue against African slavery, cruel punishments, despotic monarchs, and the execution of witches and heretics. With enough scrutiny by disinterested, rational, and informed thinkers, these practices cannot be justified indefinitely. The universe of ideas, in which one idea entails others, is itself an exogenous force. And once a community of thinkers enters that universe, they will be forced in certain directions, regardless of their material surroundings. I think this process of moral discovery was a significant cause of the humanitarian revolution. I am prepared to take this line of explanation a step further. The reason so many violent institutions succumbed within so short a span of time was that the arguments that slew them belonged to a coherent philosophy that emerged during the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment. The ideas of thinkers like Hobbes, Spinoza, Descartes, Locke, David Hume, Mary Astell, Kant, Beccaria, Smith, Mary Wollstonecraft, Madison, Jefferson, Hamilton, and John Stuart Mill coalesced into a worldview that we can call Enlightenment humanism. It is also sometimes called classical liberalism, though since the 1960s the word liberalism has acquired other meanings as well. Here is a potted account of this philosophy, a rough but more or less coherent composite of the views of these Enlightenment thinkers. It begins with skepticism. The history of human folly and our own susceptibility to illusions and fallacies tell us that men and women are fallible. One, therefore, ought to seek good reasons for believing something. Faith, revelation, tradition, dogma, authority, the ecstatic glow of subjective certainty are all recipes for error and should be dismissed as sources of knowledge. Is there anything we can be certain of? Descartes gave as good an answer as any, our own consciousness. I know that I am conscious by the very fact of wondering what I can know, and I can also know that my consciousness comprises several kinds of experience. These include the perception of an external world and of other people, and various pleasures and pains, both sensual, such as food, comfort, and sex, and spiritual, such as love, knowledge, and an appreciation of beauty. We are also committed to reason. If we are asking a question, evaluating possible answers, and trying to persuade others of the value of those answers, then we are reasoning, and therefore have tacitly signed on to the validity of reason. We are also committed to whatever conclusions follow from the careful application of reason, such as the theorems of mathematics and logic. Though we cannot logically prove anything about the physical world, we are entitled to have confidence in certain beliefs about it. The application of reason and observation to discover tentative generalizations about the world is what we call science. The progress of science, with its dazzling success at explaining and manipulating the world, shows that knowledge of the universe is possible, albeit always probabilistic and subject to revision. Science is thus a paradigm for how we ought to gain knowledge, not the particular methods or institutions of science, but its value system, namely to seek to explain the world, to evaluate candidate explanations objectively, and to be cognizant of the tentativeness and uncertainty of our understanding at any time. The indispensability of reason does not imply that individual people are always rational or are unswayed by passion and illusion. It only means that people are capable of reason, and that a community of people who choose to perfect this faculty and to exercise it openly and fairly can collectively reason their way to sounder conclusions in the long run. As Lincoln observed, "You can fool all of the people some of the time, and you can fool some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time." Among the beliefs about the world of which we can be highly confident is that other people are conscious in the same way that we are. Other people are made of the same stuff, seek the same kinds of goals, and react with external signs of pleasure and pain to the kinds of events that cause pain and pleasure in each of us. By the same reasoning, we can infer that people who are different from us in many superficial ways, their gender, their race, their culture, are like us in fundamental ways. As Shakespeare's Shylock asks, "Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions, fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer, as a Christian is? If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge?" The commonality of basic human responses across cultures has profound implications. One is that there is a universal human nature. It encompasses our common pleasures and pains, our common methods of reasoning, and our common vulnerability to folly, not least the desire for revenge. Human nature may be studied, just as anything else in the world may be, and our decisions on how to organize our lives can take the facts of human nature into account, including the discounting of our own intuitions when a scientific understanding casts them in doubt. The other implication of our psychological commonality is that however much people differ, there can be, in principle, a meeting of the minds. I can appeal to your reason and try to persuade you, applying standards of logic and evidence that both of us are committed to by the very fact that we are both reasoning beings. The universality of reason is a momentous realization because it defines a place for morality. If I appeal to you to do something that affects me, to get off my foot, or not to stab me for the fun of it, or to save my child from drowning, then I can't do it in a way that privileges my interests over yours if I want you to take me seriously, say by retaining my right to stand on your foot or to stab you or to let your children drown. I have to state my case in a way that would force me to treat you in kind. I can't act as if my interests are special just because I'm me and you're not, any more than I can persuade you that the spot I am standing on is a special place in the universe just because I happen to be standing on it. You and I ought to reach this moral understanding, not just so we can have a logically consistent conversation, but because mutual unselfishness is the only way we can simultaneously pursue our interests. You and I are both better off if we share our surpluses, rescue each other's children when they get into trouble, and refrain from knifing each other, than we would be if we hoarded our surpluses while they rotted, let each other's children drown, and feuded incessantly. Granted, I might be a bit better off if I acted selfishly at your expense and you played the sucker, but the same is true for you with me. So if each of us tried for these advantages, we'd both end up worse off. Any neutral observer, and you and I, if we could talk it over rationally, would have to conclude that the state we should aim for is the one where we both are unselfish. Morality, then, is not a set of arbitrary regulations dictated by a vengeful deity and written down in a book, nor is it the custom of a particular culture or tribe. It is a consequence of the interchangeability of perspectives and the opportunity the world provides for positive-sum games. This foundation of morality may be seen in the many versions of the Golden Rule that have been discovered by the world's major religions, and also in Spinoza's Viewpoint of Eternity, Kant's Categorical Imperative, Hobbes and Rousseau's Social Contract, and Locke and Jefferson's self-evident truth that all people are created equal. From the factual knowledge that there is a universal human nature, and the moral principle that no person has grounds for privileging his or her interests over others, we can deduce a great deal about how we ought to run our affairs. A government is a good thing to have, because in a state of anarchy, people's self-interest, self-deception, and fear of these shortcomings in others would lead to constant strife. People are better off abjuring violence, if everyone else agrees to do so, and vesting authority in a disinterested third party. But since that third party will consist of human beings, not angels, their power must be checked by the power of other people, to force them to govern with the consent of the governed. They may not use violence against their citizens beyond the minimum necessary to prevent greater violence, and they should foster arrangements that allow people to flourish from cooperation and voluntary exchange. This line of reasoning may be called humanism because the value that it recognizes is the flourishing of humans, the only value that cannot be denied. I experience pleasures and pains, and pursue goals in service of them, so I cannot reasonably deny the right of other sentient agents to do the same. If all this sounds banal and obvious, then you are a child of the Enlightenment, and have absorbed its humanist philosophy. As a matter of historical fact, there is nothing banal or obvious about it. Though not necessarily atheistic, it is compatible with a deism in which God is identified with the nature of the universe. Enlightenment humanism makes no use of scripture, Jesus, ritual, religious law, divine purpose, immortal souls, an afterlife, a messianic age, or a God who responds to individual people. It sweeps aside many secular sources of value as well, if they cannot be shown to be necessary for the enhancement of human flourishing. These include the prestige of the nation, race, or class, fetishized virtues such as manliness, dignity, heroism, glory, and honor, and other mystical forces, quests, destinies, dialectics, and struggles. I would argue that Enlightenment humanism, whether invoked explicitly or implicitly, underlay the diverse humanitarian reforms of the 18th and 19th centuries. The philosophy was explicitly invoked in the design of the first liberal democracies, most transparently in the self-evident truths in the American Declaration of Independence. Later, it would spread to other parts of the world, blended with humanistic arguments that had arisen independently in those civilizations. And as we shall see in Chapter 7, it regained momentum during the rights revolutions of the present era. For all that, Enlightenment humanism did not, at first, carry the day. Though it helped to eliminate many barbaric practices and established beachheads in the first liberal democracies, Its full implications were roundly rejected in much of the world. One objection arose from a tension between the forces of enlightenment we have been exploring in this chapter and the forces of civilization we explored in the previous one. Though, as we shall see, it is not difficult to reconcile the two. The other objection was more foundational, and its consequences more fateful. Civilization and Enlightenment. On the heels of the Enlightenment came the French Revolution, a brief promise of democracy followed by a train of regicides, putsches, fanatics, mobs, terrors, and preemptive wars, culminating in a megalomaniacal emperor and an insane war of conquest. More than 250,000 people were killed in the Revolution and its aftermath, and another 2 to 4 million were killed in the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. In reflecting on this catastrophe, it was natural for people to reason, after this, therefore because of this, and for intellectuals on the right and the left to blame the Enlightenment. "This is what you get," they say, "when you eat the fruit of the tree of knowledge, steal fire from the gods, and open Pandora's box." The theory that the Enlightenment was responsible for the Terror and Napoleon is, to put it mildly, dubious. Political murder, massacre, and wars of imperial expansion are as old as civilization, and had long been the everyday stuff of European monarchies, including that of France. Many of the French philosophes from whom the revolutionaries drew their inspiration were intellectual lightweights and did not represent the stream of reasoning that connected Hobbes, Descartes, Spinoza, Locke, Hume, and Kant. The American Revolution, which stuck more closely to the Enlightenment script, gave the world a liberal democracy that has lasted more than 2 centuries. Toward the end of this book, I will argue that the data on the historical decline of violence vindicate Enlightenment humanism and refute its critics on the right and the left. But one of these critics, the Anglo-Irish writer Edmund Burke, deserves our attention, because his argument appeals to the other major explanation for the decline of violence, the civilizing process. The two explanations overlap. Both appeal to an expansion of empathy and to the pacifying effects of positive-sum cooperation, but they differ in which aspect of human nature they emphasize. Burke was the father of intellectual secular conservatism, which is based on what the economist Thomas Sowell has called a tragic vision of human nature. In that vision, human beings are permanently saddled with limitations of knowledge, wisdom, and virtue. People are selfish and short-sighted, and if they are left to their own devices, they will plunge into a Hobbesian war of all against all. The only things that keep people from falling into this abyss are the habits of self-control and social harmony they absorb when they conform to the norms of a civilized society. Social customs, religious traditions, sexual mores, family structures, and long-standing political institutions, even if no one can articulate their rationale, are time-tested workarounds for the shortcomings of an unchanging human nature and are as indispensable today as when they lifted us out of barbarism. According to Burke, no mortal is smart enough to design a society from first principles. A society is an organic system that develops spontaneously, governed by myriad interactions and adjustments that no human mind can pretend to understand. Just because we cannot capture its workings in verbal propositions does not mean it should be scrapped and reinvented according to the fashionable theories of the day. Such ham-fisted tinkering will only lead to unintended consequences, culminating in violent chaos. Burke clearly went too far. It would be mad to say that people should never have agitated against torture, witch hunts, and slavery, because these were long-standing traditions, and that if they were suddenly abolished, society would descend into savagery. The practices themselves were savage. And as we have seen, societies find ways to compensate for the disappearance of violent practices that were once thought to be indispensable. Humanitarianism can be the mother of invention. But Burke had a point. Unspoken norms of civilized behavior, both in everyday interactions and in the conduct of government, may be a prerequisite to implementing certain reforms successfully. The development of these norms may be the mysterious historical forces that Paine remarked on, such as the spontaneous fading of political murder well before the principles of democracy had been articulated, and the sequence in which some abolition movements gave the coup de grace to practices that were already in decline. They may explain why today it is so hard to impose liberal democracy on countries in the developing world that have not outgrown their superstitions, warlords, and feuding tribes. Civilization and enlightenment need not be alternatives in explaining declines in violence. In some periods, tacit norms of empathy, self-control, and cooperation may take the lead, and rationally articulated principles of equality, nonviolence, and human rights may follow. In other periods, it may go in the other direction. This to and fro may explain why the American Revolution was not as calamitous as its French counterpart. The founders were products not just of the Enlightenment, but of the English civilizing process, and self-control and cooperation had become second nature to them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation, the Declaration politely explains. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. Prudence indeed. But their decency and prudence were more than mindless habits. The founders consciously deliberated about just those limitations of human nature that made Burke so nervous about conscious deliberation. "What is government itself," asked Madison, "but the greatest of all reflections on human nature?" Democracy, in their vision, had to be designed to counteract the vices of human nature, particularly the temptation in leaders to abuse their power. An acknowledgement of human nature may have been the chief difference between the American revolutionaries and their French confrères, who had the romantic conviction that they were rendering human limitations obsolete. In 1794, Maximilien Robespierre, architect of the Terror, wrote, "The French people seem to have outstripped the rest of humanity by 2,000 years. One might be tempted to regard them, living amongst them, as a different species." In The Blank Slate, I argued the two extreme visions of human nature, a tragic vision that is resigned to its flaws, and a utopian vision that denies it exists, define the great divide between right-wing and left-wing political ideologies. And I suggested that a better understanding of human nature in the light of modern science can point the way to an approach to politics that is more sophisticated than either. The human mind is not a blank slate, and no humane political system should be allowed to deify its leaders or remake its citizens. Yet for all its limitations, human nature includes a recursive, open-ended, combinatorial system for reasoning, which can take cognizance of its own limitations. That is why the engine of Enlightenment humanism, rationality, can never be refuted by some flaw or error in the reasoning of the people in a given era. Reason can always stand back, take note of the flaw, and revise its rules so as not to succumb to it the next time. Blood and Soil. A second counter-Enlightenment movement took root in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, and was centered not in England, but in Germany. The various strands have been explored in an essay by Isaiah Berlin, and a book by the philosopher Graham Garrard. This counter-Enlightenment originated with Rousseau, and was developed by theologians, poets, and essayists such as Johann Hamann, Friedrich Jacobi, Johann Herder, and Friedrich Schelling. Its target was not, as it was for Burke, the unintended consequences of Enlightenment reason for social stability, but the foundations of reason itself. The first mistake, they said, was to start from the consciousness of an individual mind. The disembodied individual reasoner, ripped from his culture and its history, is a figment of the Enlightenment thinker's imagination. A person is not a locus of abstract cogitation, a brain on a stick, but a body with emotions and a part of the fabric of nature. The second mistake was to posit a universal human nature and a universal valid system of reasoning. People are embedded in a culture and find meaning in its myths, symbols, and epics. Truth does not reside in propositions in the sky, there for everyone to see, but is situated in narratives and archetypes that are particular to the history of a place and give meaning to the lives of its inhabitants. In this way of thinking, for a rational analyst to criticize traditional beliefs or customs is to miss the point. Only if one enters into the experience of those who live by those beliefs can one truly understand them. The Bible, for example, can be appreciated only by reproducing the experience of ancient shepherds in the Judean hills. Every culture has a unique Schwerpunkt, a center of gravity, and unless we try to occupy it, we cannot comprehend its meaning and value. Cosmopolitanism, far from being a virtue, is a shedding of all that makes one most human, most oneself. Universality, objectivity, and rationality are out. Romanticism, vitalism, intuition, and irrationalism are in. Herder summed up the Sturm und Drang, storm and impulse movement he helped to inspire, "I am not here to think, but to be, feel, live. Heart, warmth, blood, humanity, life." A child of the counter-enlightenment, then, does not pursue a goal because it is objectively true or virtuous, but because it is a unique product of one's creativity. The wellspring of creativity may be in one's own true self, as the Romantic painters and writers insisted, or it may be in some kind of transcendent entity, a cosmic spirit, a divine flame. Berlin elaborates. Others again identify the creative self with a superpersonal organism, of which they saw themselves as elements or members, nation or church or culture or class or history itself, a mighty force of which they conceived their earthly selves as emanations. Aggressive nationalism, self-identification with the interests of the class, the culture or the race, or the forces of progress, with the wave of the future-directed dynamism of history, something that at once explains and justifies acts which might be abhorred or despised if committed from calculation of selfish advantage or some other mundane motive, this family of political and moral conceptions is so many expressions of a doctrine of self-realization based on defiant rejection of the central theses of the Enlightenment, according to which what is true or right or good or beautiful can be shown to be valid for all men by the correct application of objective methods of discovery and interpretation open to anyone to use and verify. The Counter-Enlightenment also rejected the assumption that violence was a problem to be solved. Struggle and bloodshed are inherent in the natural order and cannot be eliminated without draining life of its vitality and subverting the destiny of mankind. As Herder put it, "Men desire harmony, but nature knows better what is good for the species. It desires strife." The glorification of the struggle in nature red in tooth and claw, as Tennyson had put it, was a pervasive theme in 19th century art and writing. Later it would be retrofitted with a scientific patina in the form of social Darwinism, though the connection with Darwin is anachronistic and unjust. The Origin of Species was published in 1859, long after romantic struggleism had become a popular philosophy, and Darwin himself was a thoroughgoing liberal humanist. The Counter-Enlightenment was the wellspring of a family of romantic movements that gained strength during the 19th century. Some of them influenced the arts and gave us sublime music and poetry. Others became political ideologies and led to horrendous reversals in the trend of declining violence. One of these ideologies was a form of militant nationalism that came to be known as blood and soil. The notion that an ethnic group and the land from which it originated form an organic whole with unique moral qualities, and that its grandeur and glory are more precious than the lives and happiness of its individual members. Another was romantic militarism, The idea that, as Mueller has summarized it, war is noble, uplifting, virtuous, glorious, heroic, exciting, beautiful, holy, thrilling. A third was Marxist socialism, in which history is a glorious struggle between classes, culminating in the subjugation of the bourgeoisie and the supremacy of the proletariat. And a fourth was national socialism, in which history is a glorious struggle between races, culminating in the subjugation of inferior races and the supremacy of the Aryans. The humanitarian revolution was a milestone in the historical reduction of violence and is one of humanity's proudest achievements. Superstitious killing, cruel punishments, frivolous executions, and chattel slavery may not have been obliterated from the face of the earth, but they have certainly been pushed to the margins. And despotism and major war, which had cast their shadow on humanity since the beginning of civilization, began to show cracks. The philosophy of Enlightenment humanism that united these developments got a toehold in the West and bided its time until more violent ideologies tragically ran their course. Chapter 5. The Long Peace. War appears to be as old as mankind, but peace is a modern invention. Henry Maine. In the early 1950s, two eminent British scholars reflected on the history of war and ventured predictions on what the world should expect in the years to come. One of them was Arnold Toynbee, 1889 through 1975, perhaps the most famous historian of the 20th century. Toynbee had served in the British Foreign Office during both world wars, had represented the government at the peace conferences following each one, and had been chronicling the rise and fall of 26 civilizations in his monumental 12-volume work, A Study of History. The patterns of history, as he saw them in 1950, did not leave him optimistic. In our recent Western history, war has been following war in an ascending order of intensity, and today it is already apparent that the war of 1939 through 45 was not the climax of this crescendo movement. Writing in the shadow of World War II, and at the dawn of the Cold War and the nuclear age, Toynbee could certainly be forgiven for his bleak prognostication. Many other distinguished commentators were equally pessimistic, and predictions of an imminent doomsday continued for another three decades. The other scholars' qualifications could not be more different. Lewis Fry Richardson, 1881 through 1953, was a physicist, meteorologist, psychologist, and applied mathematician. His main claim to fame had been devising numerical techniques for predicting the weather, decades before there were computers powerful enough to implement them. Richardson's own prediction about the future came not from erudition about great civilizations, but from statistical analysis of a data set of hundreds of violent conflicts spanning more than a century. Richardson was more circumspect than Toynbee, and more optimistic. The occurrence of two world wars in the present century is apt to leave us with the vague belief that the world has become more warlike. But this belief needs logical scrutiny. A long future may perhaps be coming without a third world war in it. Richardson chose statistics over impressions to defy the common understanding that global nuclear war was a certainty. More than half a century later, we know that the eminent historian was wrong and the obscure physicist was right. This chapter is about the full story behind Richardson's prescience, the trends in war between major nations culminating in the unexpected good news that the apparent crescendo of war did not continue to a new climax. During the last two decades, the world's attention has shifted to other kinds of conflict, including wars in smaller countries, civil wars, genocides, and terrorism. They will be covered in the following chapter. Statistics and narratives. The 20th century would seem to be an insult to the very suggestion that violence has declined over the course of history. Commonly labeled as the most violent century in history, its first half saw a cascade of world wars, civil wars, and genocides that Matthew White has called the hemoclism, the blood flood. The hemoclism was not just an